the transmission of light assembly continues. Welcome to those arriving today. Welcome back to those continuing. We've reached our first ancestor in Japan in the transmission of light record. We've brought up and examined all the Chinese ancestors from Bodhidharma through Tiantong Rujing over the past few years. And now the 51st ancestor was priest Ehe Dogen. Eternal peace, source of the way. He studied with priest Tiantong Rujing once during late night zazen. Rujing told the monks, "Practicing Zen is dropping off body and mind." Hearing this, Dogen was suddenly greatly awakened. Daigo. He deeply understood what he had not before understood. He perceived what he had not previously perceived. He realized something new and fresh. He went at once, in parentheses, he waited to the end of zazen. And then went at once to the abbot's room and burned incense. Rujing asked him, "Why are you burning incense?" Dogen said, "Body and mind have dropped off." Rujing said, "Body and mind dropped off. The dropped off body and mind." Dogen said, "Actually, this is a temporary ability. Please don't give me your seal of approval arbitrarily, or easily, or hastily, or without reason." Are different translations. Rujing replied, "I'm not approving you easily." Dogen asked, "What is not approved easily?" Or this translation says, "Why are you not approving me too easily? Or why are you not approving me without reason?" I kind of like, what is not approved without reason? Dogen asked, and Rujing said, "Dropped off body and mind." Dogen bowed in prostration. Rujing said, "The dropped off is dropped off." Then Rujing's attendant, the Jisha Huang Ping of Fuzhou, said, "It's no small thing for a foreigner to experience this realm, or to experience what it is, or to experience thus." It's that phrase, imo. No small thing for a foreigner to be thus. Emo is one of those phrases that means like, just like in English, to realize thus, as he's just said, and also playing with this term thus, or such, thusness and suchness, meaning the reality realm. Rujing said, how many here have gotten it? Or another translation is, how many times has he been pummeled around here? Liberated or dropped off, he is mild and peaceful, or he is dignified and peaceful, and the thunder roars. Alleluia! One of the great stories of our lineage, cropping up at the end of the book. This may be the longest chapter in this record of transmission of light, maybe just because Kazon, who compiled it, knew most about Dogen because he was only lived 50 or so years before him, and living students of Dogen were still around, and so they knew more stories, so he could write more compared to the obscurity of Rujing, who nobody knew. Except there was, I think, at least one monk from a student of Rujing, a Chinese monk, who then later came over to Japan to practice with Dogen. So there's a long story of Dogen's life, and well, maybe we'll skip little sections, but I thought so far we've been not really skipping around. At least let's hear some of Dogen's life. Dogen personally is my great hero. In some ways, maybe more than Shakyamuni Buddha, just because I think Dogen's practice is closer to our practice, right? It's more similar in some ways than so long ago in India. And the Buddha's life is so dramatic. Dogen's has some drama too, but maybe we can relate to it more easily, and we can see his transformation. So it's almost like the life of Buddha to read Dogen's life, I feel like. I never get tired of it. All those details of his life when I read it again and again. And then the end of this section on long section on Dogen is Kazon's commentary on the root case, which the story of dropped off body and mind. And personally, again, I feel like this is one of Kazon's most lucid commentaries in this record. There's a few that, you know, for me really stand out. Maybe five or so. Wow, Kazon really hit the nail on the head, or really opened up the story in a new way. I think sometimes maybe these are talks, Dharma talks that Kazon gave over the course of, I think, about a year. Sometimes maybe he was like, had a tired day. He just didn't have much to say about some ancestors. But it's a great exposition of, and a kind of surprising take maybe, detailed exposition of Dogen's dropping off body and mind. But since we might not get to that, we probably won't get to that today. It'll probably take a couple of days to get through Dogen's story here. Let's stop for a moment and consider this amazing story. dropping off body and mind. Which Rujing brought up the phrase, and Dogen heard it, and through those words, something, it was just enough to nudge Dogen over the edge into dropped off body and mind, into dropping off. So we might say, is this just a matter of not grasping the body and mind, or not identifying myself with the body and mind? Like, is it just a matter of seeing that it's not my body and mind? That may be one way to see it, but Keizan presents it in a deeper way, I would say, than that. Coming from our own experience in these days of sitting where we have so much opportunity to deeply investigate our own experience of Zazen, we can examine, first of all, the body. What is this body? Apart from our stories about it and our ideas and concepts about it, in our direct experience, what is this body? We have some sense of the body, right? Always. It's maybe the most prevalent piece of our experience, actually. And yet, because of that, because it's so prevalent, it's easy to not look more deeply. Well, what is actually, personally, this experience of the body? And we have tools, of course, from our many centuries of body and mind investigators to help us. So one ancient tool, kind of like a, almost like a framework to, in which to examine the body, is the five senses. And maybe particularly the fifth physical sense is like, you know, the tactile sense. We might even say the body, the sense organ called the body. Like, this is an example how we usually don't think of the body as a sense organ. But in terms of our experience, to me, that's how it seems today. If I look in a direct experience, what is this body? It's a sensation. And a little bit more detailed way, it would be that there's the body faculty. It's like, if the body is a sense organ, the body faculty is like the ability to perceive touch. Yeah? And maybe in modern physical explanation, we would say like the nervous system, maybe. The Buddha didn't really know about modern physiology, but that's how it seems to me, is like the nerve endings, This is how we experience the body. What is this body? I'm basically getting my experience of the body starting with the nerve endings on the skin. And my understanding is that there are nerve endings like internally, yeah? Even things like in the stomach. Is that right? I don't know this much about biology. Don't know much about biology. No. Can't remember all that. I just remember Abhidharma. experiencing like a queasy stomach. I think that's, you know, biology would say there's nerve endings in the stomach that are like sending signals to the brain. Maybe the Buddha would say there's a tactile receptivity in the stomach that's actually perceived by the body consciousness. Each of the five physical senses has a faculty, which is like the organ, has an object, which is like the zafu, touching the bottom, you know, the wood touching the hand, and then the consciousness is when the faculty of the nerve, you know, the physical receptivity touches the object. There's a consciousness. And the Buddha's way of talking about it is that each sense has its own consciousness. So there's a body consciousness. And we say the direct experience of the body before there's any conceptual thought about it or naming it or anything. My understanding, at least from an Abhidharma perspective, is we would call it the body consciousness, where it's like an awareness of where the tactile receptivity touches an object. So it's maybe kind of a detailed explanation of one framework for looking at what is the direct experience of the body in this moment. I say, well, it's just this feeling. But well, what is that actually? We look deeper. Oh, it's a sensation of contact. It's an experience of contact of faculty and object, and there's a consciousness that makes it. It's like the experience of it makes it experienceable. And then along with that's like actually in terms of the five skandhas, that's considered the first skandha. Is the body faculty, all five sense faculties, and all five sense objects. And there's different versions of this, but rupa skanda, form skanda, according to Vasubandhu's version of Abhidharma. There's these 10 types of rupa skanda, of form. Sometimes we just abbreviate and say, well, form skanda is just the body. But, you know, Abhidharma Kosha is kind of in our, sort of the basis of our understanding this from our tradition is like, actually, strictly speaking, form skanda is the five sense faculties and the five sense objects. And that is like kind of like, almost like a kind of physical, the physical realm. Colors are actually physical. Colors, sounds, tastes, smells, and tangibles are the physical world, and eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body are the physical body. But I think in this case, we can focus on just the fifth sense, the body sense. And then the second skanda is feeling, right? Which is just my understanding is kind of like the raw, sensory data of just pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, which is there, one of these, as I understand it, as soon as there's the contact of the faculty and the object, the sensation, there is a sensation there. there isn't really any contact without sensation. There can't, as soon as there's contact, there is sensation, but they can be distinguished. And so, again, our experience of the body is this direct contact. Along with that comes a sensation. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral physical sensation. And so when I use that framework to look at the experience of body now, it seems like that's getting pretty close, pretty direct. I mean, this is a lot of words, right? But it's a description of the most direct experience of what's actually the body experience right now. If I had to put it into words, maybe I'm kind of biased. Having looked at this Abhidharma stuff, maybe you wouldn't have such a convoluted explanation of the body experience. But maybe you can put it more simply, but how do you put it really accurately? You can't say, well, it's this physical thing. Well, what is that, actually? What's your actual experience of it? What's the direct experience? Seems like it's a contact with a sensation. So in this way, our experience of the body is purely like a mental image, you could say, even before we project words and names and ideas onto it. Which is why when the usual consciousnesses are not operating, like when we're asleep, there isn't an experience of the body. Unless we're like, you know, our sort of half wake up, tossing and turning, then it's like we're half coming into body consciousness and sensation. But in deep sleep, right, it's like there isn't really a body in terms of experience. You know, and just say, well, of course there's a body there. But in our experience, there's not really a body until there's a consciousness, awareness of it. So, could we say that then sleeping is dropping off body? Maybe in a way. I think we could, you know. Yes.
My experience of sleeping is when I have dreams that are disturbing, my body is
involved.
Mm-hmm. And when I wake up, sometimes I wake up and I'm just exhausted.
Hmm. Yeah.
So,
I think depending on the person and the dream, I think the dream state can be like that. The dreaming can involve the actual physical body. Like some people are like running in a dream and their body in the bed starts running or sort of moving. So sometimes I think the dream state connects to the physical body, and sometimes I think it doesn't also. Like we're flying in the dream, but the physical body is not moving or necessarily tense. But it can be, yeah.
Anxiety.
Yeah.
Can be associated with.
Yeah. And I would guess that that's probably so because the whole like mind experience of the world and images and so on is so deeply connected with the body experience. They're like wired together so intimately in our waking life that in the dream realm, where it's kind of not really real, the things we're seeing are not really there, but the wiring is still working. So I think that's maybe why it can still work that way. I remember as a kid we heard this story, and then we would try to do this at like sleepover parties and stuff. We hear like, if you a sleeping person, especially if they're dreaming, if you put their hand in water, they'll pee. You heard that? Warm water, yeah. So that says Johnny's sleeping there. Let's try it out. I don't know if it ever worked. But so, yeah, I think dreaming maybe is a different category, but like deep dreamless sleep, maybe like a version, some kind of version of dropped off body. But it's interesting that it doesn't appear in this version of the story, but there's various versions of Dogen's dropping off body and mind story, and one of them I think is something like it's late night sitting, it does say here, and a lot of the monks are like sleeping in the zendo and nodding off, and Rujing is coming around, as Dogen says, with his slipper and kind of like whacking people and wake them up. kind of admonishes the monk sitting next to Dogen. Of course, Dogen's always like totally awake, right? But the monk next to him is dozing, and Dogen, Rujing says something like, one version, a simple version, is how can you drop off body and mind when you're sleeping? I think there's another version that maybe even says like, we need to practice just completely sitting. If you're just completely sleeping, like Shikan sleeping, how can you drop off body and mind? So later the, you know, tradition embellishes and plays with the story. But I think that's an interesting point, because you might say it brings up this issue of like, well, isn't actually sleeping kind of is like dropping body? And Rujing says, how can you drop off body when you're sleeping? So we might, you know, today I might say it like, it is a kind of dropping off the body, it seems like, but there's no, you can't do anything with it. It's you can't recognize or appreciate it and use it in your life. Because we all drop off the body every night since we were born, and but so what? But if when you're awake, if you can drop off the body when you're awake, that could be quite useful. Especially if we're having an experience of discontent or suffering related to the body. Because we think that, again, not only that it's my body, that's maybe like a kind of a grosser level, but I think still quite profound to see, actually there's a body here and it's a total pain, but it's not mine, and there's no I that owns it or possesses it. That's pretty good, but again, I think Keizan goes deeper. Yes.
Sounds like you're pointing to like dropping off body where there's no sensation you're talking about.
No, maybe I haven't finished the story yet.
Okay. Oh wait.
So there is sensation, right? This is what is the experience of the body, right? It is sensation. It's a contact, right? It's the sense faculty of body meeting the object. There's contact and there's sensation. That's the experience of the body. And so if we understand it deeply like that, that is what the body is, as far as we know and experience. There's no other like real kind of solid body apart from this sensation, actually. And then we can ask, what is the sensation? What is this, which is particularly this pleasant or unpleasant sensation? What is that actually? This is something I've been trying to work with for some years in really direct experience. It's just, you know, unpleasant is something to like, get it, stop it, whatever. I don't care what it is, just stop it. It's usually how I relate to it if I'm not paying attention. Let's just like, it's just unpleasant, period. But then like, well, what is unpleasant? What is that kind of throbbing sensation in the butt where it meets the cushion? And it's almost like it's impossible, when I really look into it, it's impossible to say. I feel like I can't really, it's almost like I can't say anything beyond it's painful, meaning like part of our wiring, in our whole, you know, body-mind system, is that this throbbing sensation is classified as unpleasant, means like, I think it's a biological, evolved phenomena, right? In order to get us to move off this cushion. Mother Nature has designed us to associate this particular sensation with unpleasant. But when I try to make that link of what makes it unpleasant, I can't actually figure it out. I can't really find it. So it's just pure sensation. So my understanding right now is something like that we could see dropping off body in this case as like that's all it is. So there is a sensation, but in the most direct, unnamed, unelaborated, and unreified way. So in a way, when we get to that level of sensation, well, what is this sensation? It's impossible to say what it is, even though I feel like very in touch with it right here. Maybe I've never felt more attentive to the sensation, and at that point, I feel like it's disappearing as a sensation, which means it's still this throbbing thing, but it's like, I can't even call it throbbing. I can't call it, even the word sensation doesn't hold anymore. It starts to become a very strange occurrence. But it's not like, it's like, it turns into pleasant or neutral, because that would be just another sensation. So this could be one way to look at dropping off body, when it becomes, we're so at one with the experience of body in the direct sensation aspect of it, that it's actually not sensation anymore. Not like it changes into something else.
No pleasant.
Yeah, no pleasant. Yeah. That would be like still involved in naming sensations and so on. Does that make more sense? So this kind of drop off is like nothing actually changes. It's not like magically the physical sensation changes into something else. It's more like the attention is so deeply boring into the direct experience of it that it's actually, even the word sensation, even the word throbbing, and certainly the word unpleasant, don't apply anymore. I think you could say this about any experience. When you go really deeply, deeply into the, settled completely into the experience, when the experience is settled completely on the experience, it's like inconceivable. It's like it doesn't disappear, but in a way, it disappears, or the old version of it disappears, you could say. The old mind ceases to exist. There's certainly, it's not that there's nothing happening, it's just that it can't be named, perceived in any fixed way. We were talking about like very subtle, fixed, meaning like it's really, like conceiving of it would be a fixation. Yes.
Isn't it really that what drops off is mind's story about body? I mean, I'm not trying to challenge Rujing and the great statement of drop off body and mind. I'm just trying to go into my very own experience and listening to you, which I relate to because I've had that experience as well, that it feels to me that what drops away is the conversation, the resistance, the interpretation,
mm-hmm.
the naming, the body kind of, it's almost like to become so body that that's all body only. You know, that's why I've always sort of said body only, not mind only. That mind feels to me like the thing that I effort to drop.
Well, you could say
body. I mean, body dropping away to me, that would be parinirvana. That's when the body really drops away.
But again, we're looking at body as an experience. If we say body is this thing that weighs a certain amount and is made out of flesh and stuff, that's not an experience. That's just an idea, right? Our experience of body is a mental experience, right?
So that's why. To me, I think of it as it's the mind that drops away. It actually allows body to just be unhindered.
Well, what you said was the story about it, and I think that's right. I think this way that I've been describing is stories, but I think the danger of using the word story in this case is we think of stories as a very kind of elaborate thing of like, it's this way or it's that way. It's very discursive.
Uh-huh.
And this is much more subtle than that, right?
Yeah.
But you could say it's a kind of story. It's the very subtle story that this is a body, you could say. That's the most... There's grosser stories like this body is like painful, this body is pleasant, this body weighs this much, this body is made. Those are all like our common stories. But then you could say the subtlest story we have about everything is that it is. This is a body. This is the body. That's a story. It's not a discursive story. It's just the way we relate to the world. It seems to exist. But we could call that a story. It's just that I might not use the word story in this case because then we go up a level to like kind of discursive story. So in this case, it's the most basic story that there is a body drops away and now there's no body. And that's what the Heart Sutra says, right?
Well, there's no body because we are completely body.
You could say we're completely body, but
there's no us to think it.
Or you could maybe say the way we practice to realize no body is to be completely body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this, you know, this Abhi, for me, this kind of Abhidharma, more like more careful or maybe more elaborate approach helps me cut through various levels of, well, it's just, okay, I just, sometimes when I think of, maybe it's just me, but when I think mindfulness of body, I think I stay at a kind of grosser level, like, yeah, okay, I feel it, it's here, it's the body. And this is more like getting so one with body that actually it's not a body. Yes.
So are you saying then, kind of in the Abhidharma view of it, that it's just this collection of senses, contacts, and
yeah,
in other words,
different conditions?
It's not this kind of one thing. It's just
yeah.
this collection
mm-hmm.
of faculties,
yeah.
contacts,
and yeah, faculties. Exactly. And what strikes me especially with Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha is that the form skanda, we usually think of as solidity. And there are versions in the Pali Canon that talk about the form skanda the Buddha sometimes defines as the four great elements, like earth, water, fire, wind, which is like physicality. So I think I really appreciate how Vasubandhu kind of looks, well, what are actually fire, wind, earth, and water in terms of experience? I think Vasubandhu is going even more deeply into the direct experience, and then we see that body is not actually like physical. Maybe that's the point. So maybe when we say just body, like body only, here we can see what if we mean just physicality, just like material solidity, then I would think no, because our experience is actually not material solidity.
Well, it's energy.
It's maybe like energy. Mm-hmm. You could say energy is like, I mean, Abhidharma doesn't have to use this word energy, right? Because it may be because we have to define what we mean. But maybe we'd say when the faculty and the object and the consciousness arise together, which they say they arise together. It's not like one comes before the other. When these three come together, we have a direct experience of body. If we call that triangle energy, a particular kind of energy, then I think we could. It's this energy that's kind of before it's named. And if there's like, you know, physicality or materiality, like a solid body, we don't know. We can't know that. We can't experience solidity. All we can experience is a faculty meeting an object. We could call that solidity. We could say when the faculty meets we often say this feels like solidity. But then do we think that there's really like something solid, or is it like a nerve ending is what we're experiencing? So the body's like nerve endings. In a way, I think nerve endings that are translating, this is now biology, and translating signals to the brain, and the amazing wiring of our system, right? That the brain then it can interpret, like I feel down, like spatially, it interprets spatially, right? It's like this is a sensation down here, and it feels like my consciousness is in the butt, right? I mean, that's how we're fooled into thinking like this is the body is down here, but actually this whole thing is happening in these like neural pathways, but it's beautifully designed. I mean, this is also, you could say, this is a meditation on the miraculousness of life, that it can work this way, that we can, the sensation, again, my understanding of biology, the contact on the nerve here, the nerve goes up to the brain, processes it, and then kind of like does some, like the processing up in the brain, we could say, is creating an image of something happening spatially down here. Isn't that weird? But we think it's actually happening down here. Biology would say it's happening like in the brain. This sensation down here is in the brain. But the Buddha doesn't talk this way, right? He says there is no brain. The brain is just another idea too, right? It's an unlocatable mind. Yes.
Your phrase just referred to the question I was about to ask. In this model, where does the mind exist?
In the Buddha's teaching, I don't know how much they knew about the physical brain organ, but it seems like in the descriptions of mind and consciousness, all five skandhas. In fact, can we say that? Definitely the last four skandhas have no location in space, right? The first skandha form, I guess we say it does have, that does have, if we say, because it's these five faculties, so they actually do have locations. The eyes and the ears and the nose have like what we call anyway, spatial locations. But the experience that doesn't have a location actually. But the wiring makes it seem as if the seeing, well, this is actually kind of an interesting one. I think if you take seeing, actually it doesn't really seem, our usual everyday life, at least for me, doesn't seem like the seeing is happening here. It seems like the seeing is happening like everywhere. But if we look closer, I'd be like, well, actually when I go like this, and it's kind of, I can see actually this experience, this visual experience must be coming through here because I'm going to do this kind of experiment. So there is a kind of seeming location with the five physical senses, but the experience of the visual consciousness and the mental consciousness, of course. But even the visual consciousness seems to have no location either. It's just the raw data is coming through a particular location. Yeah, Ellen.
I'd like to bring the breath into this conversation because, from studying especially Tai Chi for so long, the breath is so essential to the harmony of the body.
Yeah.
And the breath is not just us, but it's the universe, it's what's around us, and it's what tells us we're not separate. Because without everything else, we wouldn't be able to exist. Without being able to breathe the air,
if the
universe wasn't here.
That's one way that connects us, is the breath. One of many infinite ways that connect us, but it's a good one.
And it's
important
way of harmonizing all the sensations.
Yeah.
And I remember, I don't know if you ever did any sensory awareness.
Oh yeah,
workshops.
Charlotte Selver, yeah.
I did one of the last workshops with Charlotte Selver at Green Gulch, and I brought my son with me. He was in high school at the time. And after a few exercises, Charlotte gathered us and wanted some feedback. And my son, when he went up, he said, "I realized that I had a body." And because he's very intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
And so by going through the sensory awareness exercises, he got in touch with his body.
Yeah.
And then I think of, you know, in Zazen, of course.
Yeah.
Breathing is what helps us.
Yeah. So I think about that point, it seems to me like the practice of, if we're going with some version like this, if some version of this explanation is like dropping off body, the practice of how we approach this is first getting very in touch with the body, and we might say, realizing for the first time I have a body. That's a kind of a grosser level, but we can't, if we bypass that, it's like impossible. So we really get in touch with the body, putting aside all the stories. Sometimes, we lose, like when we're really caught up in some mental activity and we kind of forget about the body, I say that's not dropping off body. That's like losing touch with the body. This kind of dropping off body is being so completely embodied. Becoming so completely into the body that and examining closely what is it actually that examining so deeply what is it that we can't find it, and that not finding it is the dropping off. And then your point about the breath, I think, is also an interesting one. That, you know, you could say that's the practice of working with coming into the body, and then it's also related to what we call like the subtle body. So this kind of Abhidharma explanation is more about the gross body, which is like what we think of as like a solid physical body. But in our direct experience, we can start to question whether it's solid and physical. And then the subtle body is actually not physical, or sometimes it's called like subtle physicality, because it's not purely mental, but you can't like extract the subtle body and put it out on the lab table or something. It's like chi and prana and breath body, and almost like it seems to be what one way that kind of connects what we think of as a gross physical body with the mind. It's like this bridge that harmonizes body and mind. So for Zazen, we use the breath to circulate more and more freely, to settle the body very deeply, and then we can start examining like this, which is another good important point, I think, here, is that this explanation, if we're trying to do in Zazen, like going really into the direct experience of the body, if there's a lot of tension in the body, it seems to not work. I mean, maybe it could potentially work, but I think the tension is like too much of a distraction. from the direct experience. It tends to be, in my experience. So almost like this more subtle investigation of what is this actually, I feel like I can't really do until the breath is really harmonizing the body and mind. We're really present in the experience of the present. There's not much. Most of the stories about, well, certainly that aren't about the body and mind at all, or they're about some other time and place, those have really settled. Now there's still some stories about the body, like my butt is actually really hurting. Like maybe it's getting, like, but we're getting closer now to what's actually happening. But like, that's okay. That's part of sesshin, I recall. It's a very familiar sensation. It's okay. And I'll just like sit with the painful butt for a few more days. So since I'm not, can't get out of it anyway, let's just relax. Painful butt. And then we start going deeper into like, well, what is this? Now it's an unpleasant sensation. Unpleasant sensation. Unpleasant sensation. Let's get it to end. No, that's not bad. I'll get distracted. Just unpleasant sensation. Unpleasant. Unpleasant. Well, why is it so unpleasant? Because it is. No, really, why? Let's check it out. I think that question actually for me is a deeply profound one. Why is something unpleasant unpleasant? And why is something pleasant pleasant? And personally, it seems like when I look at that at the deepest level that I can find, there's no answer. It's almost random. It feels like it's almost random. And it's at this level of like, it's just pure biology. It's just like, that's how we're designed. But what we call unpleasant is is a sensation that's designed to create aversion. Can we say that? Maybe this is an interesting way to look at this issue, that what we call an unpleasant sensation is nothing more than a biologically evolved experience to create resistance or aversion to the feeling in order to protect us, to protect the body from pain. So it's a good thing we're averse to it, because then we don't stay in the pain and we move. But this very aversion is what's causing the trouble, right? It's like biology has set us up to like suffer, and this is kind of like going into like the roots of the biological designs and like kind of like pulling them apart a little, or just seeing like, wow, I'm driven by biology here. Like I feel like I have to move because like, you know, who did this to me? Evolution did this to me. And now I'm like being pushed and pulled and manipulated by my evolution. And like, but is it possible to be free of that? Maybe. You can be free by just like, I'm designed to be averse to this, but what if I'm not? I'm just like, it's okay to have an unpleasant sensation. And you could say, maybe we would just like reverse the course of evolution. We're like, this is kind of like a Dharma evolution now. Like, wow, maybe it's okay to just experience a sensation without trying to escape from it. And of course, you know, there's limits to this, because it wouldn't be a good reverse evolution if we just let ourselves, you know, rot away because we don't care. Well, we're not going to do that. We don't have to worry about that. Maybe the Buddha, actually, maybe he had to worry about that a little, because he kind of got kind of close to that. So if we get close, we should talk. But I don't think we're that close. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just piecing some of this apart myself, and I don't know that much about physiology, but since we're talking about it, I do understand that there's sort of a physical mechanism in the body that there's a signal isn't necessarily transmitted to the brain so that we interpret an experience. Like if we touch a hot stove, there's an immediate reflex that the body will naturally have, we say.
Before it goes to the brain?
Yeah. It just in the case of, you know, falling into a campfire or, you know, those spontaneous things that might be detrimental to the body, there's a built-in mechanism to take your hand off the stove without that reflex. And so I'm wondering about, you know, dropping off mind and body. In that sense, it wouldn't just be like, in the way we describe that, dropping off mind, because there's still this, like, natural bodily thing that helps us to recoil. And I conjure this image of, you know, the burning monk in the 60s, the self-immolating monk, sitting there burning. And it seems like, it appears like, it's not just the mind that's dropped off, so he's you know, not interpreting his experience as painful, or I got to get off this hot seat. It's like that, even that reflex isn't present. Jerking around.
I don't know about that. I mean, it was some kind of mental training there, right, to do that. But I think in general, reflex, if that's the case with those automatic reflexes, then it's almost like we don't have to worry about that. That's just fine, right? Fine, no problem with automatic reflex. Problem is when those things go into the brain and back. In fact, that's not really a problem in and of itself. It's just that that process is what we make all our problems out of. They get more and more elaborate, and the stories get more and more elaborate about the process, and then we try to manipulate all this stuff. But of course there's no reason to manipulate our reflexes in any way. So to finish the story, if dropping off body could be something, yeah. And by the way, I'm kind of just making this up, right? Kazan says something similar, but much more simply. But if, like, going into the very direct experience of the body, apart from our almost like the Abhidharma story it's another story to replace our usual story, is that the body is this solid lump. And so this is like, well, let's try a story that kind of teases apart the details of the experience. But it's another story too. We have to drop the Abhidharma thing in the direct experience. But it helps shift it, for me anyway, it helps shift it more into the direct experience. And then we can't say what it is anymore, right? We can't find pleasant, unpleasant. We can't find the contact. We can't find body consciousness. We can't find a body, actually. But something's definitely happening, right? It's not that everything stops happening. It's not like sleep at all. It's like radiantly, dynamically, lifing. Yeah. So that's the body part. And then mind, same. And maybe harder in a way, because there's, you could say then it's letting go of all the, I don't know about harder or easier, but it's, again, coming into the direct experience of the present. And we can use explanations like the five skandhas of what is the mental experience in the moment, coming so directly into it that we can't say what it is anymore. Same thing, just like we can't say what the body is, we can't say what the mind is. But it's not that, like, consciousness shuts off or something. It's just that it drops away. So body and mind dropped off doesn't mean nothing's happening anymore. It's just that there's no body in any possible way that I usually think of it or even usually experience it, because I usually experience it in a kind of a grosser way. And mind, too, the way I usually think of it or experience it, seems like, well, there's somebody up here that's kind of like pulling all these levers and pressing these buttons and walk this way, walk that way. There's some sense of me, but then even deeper than the sense of me, what is consciousness? That's why I say it might be a little bit harder, because I think it's quite hard to investigate, have consciousness be investigating what is consciousness, apart from all our ideas of it in our direct experience, coming into the present, this, and so completely this, that body and mind drop away. And and so at this time, of course, suffering of any kind is impossible, because we don't know what suffering is anymore. And then the question could arise, with this dropped off body and mind, can you do anything? What about our bodhisattva vow? Can we save all beings with the dropped off body and mind? Of course, we have to. I just thought of this one example of this. There's these, you might have heard of Genpo Roshi's Big Mind workshops.
You've been to one.
You've been to one, huh? So you probably, you maybe know of this example that I think is maybe common when you do these, is like, it's like a voice dialogue. So you become all these different, you be the wounded child, be, you know, and speak from that place of you're the wounded child, be the obsessive one, be the greedy one, be the angry one. You kind of go through all the kind of klesha minds in a direct experience, and then you start going into the more free ones. Now be like the totally present mind, and kind of, and let's have a conversation from there. And then I think that kind of culmination, or near the culmination, now be dropped off body and mind. And you've kind of gotten so used to being able to shift into these different voices that you can, I think it's quite a skillful method, actually. You can actually directly just be the dropped off body and mind. And then they'll say, now I'd like the dropped off body and mind to stand up. And so like half the room stands up and half the room doesn't stand up. Because they say, well, dropped off body and mind can't stand up. But he's like, no, body, dropped off body and mind can now stand up. Dropped off body and mind can walk around the room. Is that how you?
Well, I don't remember most of it. It's a long time ago. It was like, I don't know, 1981 or something. And I just remember at one point getting up thinking that I kind of dropped it all, because I remember making this statement or something. I thought I got it.
Yeah. Well, you might have.
Might have.
I don't know. Yeah. So you could say, but then it's harder if we're walking around. So that's why we like train in zazen. It's just easier to get into habits when doing our habitual activities. but possible, of course. Must be possible, right? It's just not identifying with the activity as what we think it is. In the direct experience of the activity, you know, like, I'm picking up a book now, I'm turning a page, but what is turning a page? I actually have no idea. I mean, I can easily fall into, I know what turning the page is. I've done it so many times, but in the direct experience, how weird. What is that? But it's not like then we can't read or something. Yes?
I just thought of what might be an example of moving in dropped off body and mind. Serving and eating. I mean, I'm thinking of maybe not so much eating, because it's easier to trip off, but when you're serving, you know, if you learn that it's not so helpful to think too much when you're serving, because it moves fairly fast and there's a lot of detail.
Yeah.
So if you can just be serving, then it might that be dropped off body and mind. There's no, you're not thinking about yourself. All you're doing is moving through time and space and giving and receiving and standing and I don't know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's a kind of a simple thing that we're all sharing right now, or service, the experience. We're,
so you say, could that be? And yes, it could be. And in fact, anything could be, right? And but I think your point is that, like, you know, and that the Zen forms, this is one way to look at Zen forms and ceremonies, is an opportunity to practice this because they're very repetitive, right? Once you kind of like sink into it and you kind of like know the routine, then it's like the same thing over and over. So the body is kind of naturally moves through. And I think we maybe all feel that, especially in Sesshin, that doing our group activities, the kind of formal activities, I think offer more of a chance than usual to enact dropped off body and mind. I mean, everything offers the opportunity every moment, but just I think these are designed to help us do that because they're simple, because they're simple and I mean, sometimes they're quite complex, right? But they're simple and direct, and when we make a more complex ceremony, I think it's just an advanced opportunity. It's like we've gotten used to the simple version, now let's tweak it a little bit and add in some fancy stuff to see if we can still just embody it. So I think what a nice way to look at ritual in Zen, yeah. Yes.
The word that has been coming up for me is resistance. And that when the mind or the body simultaneously are resisting anything, then you can't drop it off. But once all resistance, there's no resistance at all, then the mind and body drops off. And I'm thinking of two things. One is when we have pain, and you know, you just go into that pain because that's the only way to make it go away. You don't resist it.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Or the only way to be at peace with it.
Yeah. And then I once had this experience in yoga when I was doing a headstand, and you know, it was always very challenging for me. And at one moment, I must have dropped off body and mind for like an instant, and then I got terrified. Everything came back and I fell. But it was a very interesting experience.
Yeah, it's the realm of effortlessness. Yeah. At the time, again, it takes quite a bit of effort and focus to be that present. But then when dropping off drops off, it's timeless and spaceless and effortless and free and open. And so then even if we do get scared or come back into it, come back into some doing something about something, then still we're it's now informed by that. So I think it's okay even if it's just a second. And because I think at the time there's not really like analyzing anything, but there's a kind of a knowing that this is the way actually things always are. This is like reality. And like, you know, the rest of my Zazen period and the rest of my life, other than this moment, is like not, is a little bit like out of accord with reality. I'm constantly like feeling as if something's like a little bit off, or something has to be fixed, or something. I'm just thinking. You know? And at this time, it's like, the entire universe is one bright pearl and doesn't, all beings are saved, actually, right? So, and then it's about integration. Suzuki Roshi talks about this, the story that we'll get into eventually, of Togen's childhood. He became interested in Buddhism as a boy when he watched the smoke from the incense stick burning by his dead mother's body and felt the evanescence of our life. This feeling grew within him and finally resulted in his attainment of enlightenment and the development of his deep philosophy. When he saw the smoke from the incense stick and felt the evanescence of life, he felt very lonely. But that lonely feeling became stronger and stronger and flowered into enlightenment when he was 28 years old. And at the moment of enlightenment, he exclaimed, "There is no body and mind." Suzuki Roshi says it. Later he says dropped off, but this is just a, you know, a spontaneous talk. I think that's interesting that he says it that way, because I think that's the way we could see it. Dropped off body and mind means there is no body and mind, but like, you're not saying that there is no sensation or anything. It's there's not, and yet it's not that there's nothing. There's not form, feeling, perceptions, formations in consciousness, there's not pain or pleasure, there's not a body and mind, and yet there's not nothing. So at the moment of enlightenment, Dogen exclaimed, "There is no body and no mind." When he said no body and no mind, all his being in that moment became a flashing into the vast phenomenal world. A flashing which included everything, which covered everything, and which had immense quality in it. All the phenomenal world was included within it, an absolute independent existence. That was his enlightenment. And this is, I think, a wonderful section, Zen by Beginner's Mind, called The Quality of Being. And he's using this flashing into existence to talk about things abiding in their dharma positions, completely independent. We've talked about before, some of you discussed this. Things abiding in their dharma position means they're completely interdependent with everything, and they're completely independent. So he's emphasizing that there's just this flashing into existence. And maybe flash emphasizes it's just a burst of light and in one moment, and then that's it. Like a camera flash. You can't actually even see the duration. It's just whoosh, the whole room is bright light, and then it's gone like less than a finger snap. Starting from the lonely feeling of the evanescence of life, he attained the powerful experience of the quality of his being. He said, "I've dropped off body and mind." Because you think you have body or mind, you have lonely feelings. But when you realize that everything is just a flashing into the vast universe, you become very strong and your existence becomes very meaningful. This was Dogen's enlightenment, and this is our practice. because we think we have body and mind, we have all kinds of problems. Maybe that'd be another way to say it. Well, if there's no body and mind, because there is, I mean, if Avalokiteshvara's being honest when she's teaching the Heart Sutra, then there is no body and mind here. And what is there? If there's not nothing, and there's not body and mind, we could say, what is there? Flashing into existence that includes everything. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.